licensing is a relationship-based thing, and more so than any other function in publishing, I think. It's who you know, and it's who they introduce you to. And eventually, you may end up with deals because you meet these people that are interested in different things, and then you find the right connection, and magic happens.
That's Mary Jo Corshane of Griffin Publishing Consulting, LLC. And today we're going to be talking about rights, licensing, and also about the recent Frankfurt Book Fair, which was its first year as an all-digital trade show. And the question is, do such shows have any kind of permanent future? But first, welcome to Inside Independent Publishing with IBPA. I'm an independent publisher and your host, Peter Goodman of Stonebridge Press. This podcast is brought to you by IBPA, the Independent Book Publishers Association, at ibpa-online.org. IBPA's mission is to help you become a better publisher through advocacy, education, and tools for success. If you're not a member, consider joining and becoming part of the IBPA family. Now, let's get started. Today, I'm talking with Mary Jo Corshane of Griffin Publishing Consulting, LLC. So welcome to the podcast, Mary Jo.
Oh, thanks for having me, Peter. Happy to be here.
Great. And so we are speaking in, what is it? It's the beginning of November, and you have just recently attended the Frankfurt Book Fair, which this year, I believe, was first time it was a completely virtual show. That is, no going to Frankfurt, no eating bratwurst, and doing whatever else you do in Frankfurt. How was it? How would you describe that experience? Do you think it's the future of trade shows?
Well, it was definitely a very different experience because of that virtual feel and look and location. The Frankfurt organizers did their best to try and replicate some of the experiences. In fact, holding some sort of mixers that they call the Hof. And the Hof is actually a location in Frankfurt where usually a lot of agents and rights people would gather after hours to talk shop and, you know, maybe do some casual business there. And so that's all occurred this year on Zoom. So a very, very different experience. I think it's something that was really great just because there were a lot of other publishers, a lot of other agents, people that are earlier in their careers that could virtually attend Frankfurt this year, who wouldn't have been able to go anyway because it is quite an expense. But and we'll just see, I guess, how things come along in the coming months, whether or not we'll be forced into this virtual location again, or if we'll be able to go back to in person. I certainly hope we can sometime, but I don't know what it's going to be
like. I mean, I guess that's one of the big appeals of Frankfurt is being able to meet people and have a lot of serendipitous occasions.
Yes, for good luck. It's definitely licensing is a relationship based thing, and more so than any other function in publishing, I think. It's who you know, and it's who they introduce you to. And eventually, you may end up with deals because you meet these people that are interested in different things, and then you find the right connection, and magic happens.
I know that first-timers at Frankfurt are always cautioned to be sure that their appointment book is full, that they can't expect to wander around and just drop in on people and have meetings. And I suppose that was also the case with a virtual Frankfurt?
Yeah, although with the virtual Frankfurt, because it's really effectively still going on, the rights portal for Frankfurt and the website for the Frankfurt Book Fair are both still live and will stay that way until June of next year.
Oh.
So people have, instead of trying to jam meetings into a 3 or 4 day period where you'd have 15 minutes to talk about something, have now expanded and extended it to the weeks and months ahead. And it's more casual. It's definitely not been frantic. I think everybody kind of slowed down because the urgency wasn't there of like going from one booth to another or trying to meet someone in the right center and so on. So we'll, you know, we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Well, what was it like doing business for you? Did you feel that you had as much success this time as you might have had at a physical conference?
I'm going to remain cautiously optimistic still, just because it was slow, and I'm still actually digging through a lot of information. The rights portal and the website both have some great tools for trying to find connections and make those connections, but unfortunately the discoverability really wasn't as good as any of us hoped. I talked to some other rights professionals like myself, and we all agree that it's going to take some time to actually weed through a little bit more and make the new contacts versus, you know, the people we already know.
So by discoverability, you mean opportunities to find new contacts and new meeting opportunities?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. It's the platform had been around in a previous incarnation called IPR License, and then the German government came in and retooled it with the Frankfurt Book Fair people to the Frankfurt Rights Portal. And it's good, but it needs a little bit more work if it's going to be really useful. But that's okay. That's what we're getting paid for, is to go and try and make these connections so the research continues.
And were these, I guess these are visual connections, were done over some port of where you could see who you were talking to and vice versa. Was it possible for you to actually show physical material, say for illustrated books, or did you have to prep everyone by either sending PDF materials in advance or doing things like screen sharing?
Yeah, there's a lot of that going on where you are sending material. Well, you would be doing that anyway, but you'd be sending materials in advance or sending materials in answer to an email. So it's definitely the 2020 version of everything else. Instead of actually having a physical copy in front of you, you're sending digital stuff for review. And I think that also had slowed down the process a bit because people are getting the digital pieces and they're going through them at their leisure as opposed to really quickly.
Yeah. What do you think? Do you think that is just as effective? The fact that they could have it and pore over it and look at it, and as opposed to just sort of looking at a tabletop and then having to page through pages, then you put it away?
I think that actually it could be good in the long run, especially because there is more time to look at something. Whereas if you're in a meeting and you're just pulling stuff out of your bag and putting it in front of somebody, that first impression takes only seconds or milliseconds. But if someone has a digital version and they open it up, they can spend a little bit more time, even if it is only a few minutes. So I think in the long run, we're going to see some really interesting things come from that way of doing business.
Have you heard anything about Frankfurt next year? Are they are assuming that they're going to go back to a on location in Frankfurt trade show?
I think that's the plan at the moment, but as it is, I think we'll just have to see how things go next year. It was only announced, I think, yesterday that the London Book Fair, which is typically in March, is actually going to now be held in June. And they said they would make another, determination about finalizing those dates and whether they're going forward by March. So it's a lot of wait and see, I think, at this point.
Yeah, everyone is, I guess, kind of hoping that things will go back to the way they were before. But I guess most of us know that that will never actually happen. Even if Frankfurt does go back to being an all physical place, I suppose so many people had so many positive experiences and they were able to broaden their attendance, so to speak, by hosting it virtually, that they are probably going to build a very strong virtual component into the next trade show, even if it does take place in Frankfurt.
I think so. I think a lot of these shows are going to need to have that component because it became such a big thing this year. I still think that, and from everything that I've read and the other conversations that I've had, everyone is really hoping that we can get back to seeing people physically as well. But we're just going to have to wait and see.
So if someone listening to this is thinking of going to Frankfurt for the first time next year, in Germany or otherwise? When do you think they should start making their preparations?
Well, you definitely need to, if you're going to be looking at Frankfurt or any of the other international fairs, you need to start thinking about what titles you might want to present and start getting that material together sooner rather than later, because a lot of what happens at Frankfurt is more solidifying a conversation that was already started rather than really making and sealing a deal right there. Everything is done, a lot of it is done beforehand. So even the big deals that you hear about at Book Expo, at Frankfurt, at London, those have been in the process for weeks or months ahead of time. And they just held the news until the fair came along to kind of make a big impact.
Do you think it's hard for people to reach out to agents and other publishers and make these contacts online? Are publishers generally willing to meet people that way, or do they kind of have to go through someone like you or other people with a lot more experience to help kind of set the stage and do the introductions for them?
I don't think they necessarily have to have an agent or a rights manager like myself, but it is something that you have to make that investment in time. And just like finding an agent if you were an author, it can sometimes take several pitches before one actually moves through to the next stage. So it's patience and it's time. And sometimes more often than not, a publisher may not want to or may not have that ability and that time available. So then it is good to hook up with an agent or a scout or a rights person to help make those connections for you.
And this is your bread and butter or part of your sandwich anyway, the rights business. How would you describe the rights business these days? Is it a really good market for it, or is everyone kind of taking a wait and see approach to, because their own markets are suffering, or they don't know what direction things are going in, how the book business is going to be?
Well, there is a little bit of hesitation, of course, because of publishers needing to make decisions, pushing titles to other seasons, wondering about printing schedules when there are shutdowns. But in the end, everything that I'm dealing with and my colleagues are dealing with are, you know, pieces of intellectual property that have some value. And that's always been there. So there are other things that folks are looking at. Audio is really, really hot right now. Of course, the foreign language licensing is a big thing as well. And just other markets that publishers can't necessarily have their fingers in. If you're licensing something and someone else is doing it and doing it successfully, then in my mind anyway, but it's also because I'm biased to being a rights person, go and have someone do it for you and then get the royalties for it. And then you've got some more money in your pocket that you didn't have before.
Do you see any particular trends in the subject matter that is, say, for an American publisher who is looking to sell rights to either Europe or to Asia? Are there any particular subject matter that are either evergreen or that are suddenly popping up as areas of new interest?
I don't know that I've seen specific trends in what I've been doing, but I know that there is seems to be just generally a hunger for, you know, a little bit more happier stories. And I think that's just because of the mood of the world today, you know. Some self-help, some happier fiction, I guess. But it really kind of depends country to country. And it also depends around even here in the States, like what might actually compel someone. On the audio side, I think still dramas are really big, and mysteries, that kind of thing. It just really will depend upon where you're looking, what the new hot thing is.
Well, what are some of the trends, do you think, in the area of, say, copyright? Is there any new legislation or any new decisions or customs that you see evolving that might be good for people to keep an eye on?
Yeah, well, one thing I'm with IBPA, I also am on the advocacy committee, and one thing that we are watching very carefully is the CASE Act, which is a legislation that's designed to create a small claims copyright court. Because right now, if you have an infringement, you have to be prepared to go to federal court, and it's very expensive. And if you're a small publisher, you don't really have the super deep pockets that it might take if you've got something that you need to protect. The small claims court, as it's drafted right now, would it set up like a sort of tribunal with copyright officers from the Copyright Office to review a case and then make a decision with limited, you know, damages that might be awarded. But both parties have to agree to go before the tribunal instead of in front of the court. So there's a lot of things that still have to be worked out. The main thing with it is that it's currently stuck in the Senate. It passed the House easily last September, but it's been hanging out in the Senate for a long time because Senator Wyden out of Oregon has a hold on the bill. And so it hasn't even come up to the floor for a vote. So
I heard about Senator Wyden and his hold. What's behind that?
It's fairly complex, and I think we could talk about it for hours. But basically, okay. I think a lot of what his issue is he doesn't want it to become a sort of court where people would frivolously bring suits forward. A lot of his objections to the bill as it's currently written have been, you know, rewritten and negotiated back and forth with Senators Kennedy and Durbin. And basically, none of us really understand what his real hold is at the moment because we've done a lot of revisions and a lot of talking about how it could be made better. The main point of the whole thing is that if you don't want to go to the small claims court, you don't have to. You can say no. So Grandma probably wouldn't be taken to court if she somehow violated copyright, although I kind of doubt she would. But so we'll see. The hope now is that maybe since we are just past the election, although we still have to figure out what the makeup of the Senate and everything is, that maybe there might be able to push it through before the new Senate comes forward. So we'll have to see. I haven't heard anything more, but I'm expecting that there'll be an update in the next few weeks from the other folks that are involved in the working group for the CASE Act.
It certainly sounds important because there's, as you're saying, if there's an infringement regarding some IP that you happen to have ownership of, there's very little you can do without going to court, and most people aren't going to do that. And I suppose most of the infringers know that, and so they just go ahead. The internet has made it possible for anyone to steal almost anything they do. Mm-hmm. We've got over 100 books in print, and periodically I go scanning to see if I can find them online, and I always do. They're available as PDFs from some places. And sometimes complete, and sometimes without any kind of restriction. You can just go and download them. And I'm sure that's true for almost everything that's printed out there on the planet. And then I don't feel like there's anything I can do about it.
Yeah, it is a very complicated issue. And that is something that my colleagues and I on the advocacy committee are definitely working on. We're actually trying to come up with a guide to a piracy guide that IBPA members can use to help figure out what they can do and what their course of action is with regard to finding those copies online. There are things that have been put in place, namely the DMCA legislation, which is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and that basically gives a pathway to sending those folks who are infringing a notice and takedown and formalizes the procedure before you might even go to court. But it's a very confusing process. And so we're trying to see if we can help members find a way forward if they find themselves in that situation. And hopefully between that and then if the CASE Act ever ends up passing, then it would be better for small publishers and larger publishers and authors alike.
Well, good luck with that. I hope it works out. I know I've sent out my fair share of those notices, and far as I can tell, they don't really have much of an impact. It's kind of like telling the person who sends you a spam phone call that if you press 2, they'll take you off your list, and that just sort of confirms your existence and advise them that they can just keep sending you stuff. They're very untrustworthy people we're dealing with in this area, I'm afraid.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's the way it is with pirates in particular. It's kind of like a game of whack-a-mole.
Exactly.
Where
exactly.
You might be able to get one taken down in one way or another, but then another pops up. And it really, in the end, is also a business decision whether or not a small publisher is losing enough money that they really need to pursue all of them or not, or if they have the time and the money to invest in taking down all of them. So it's, you know, it definitely is a complicated process. It's not an easy thing at all, but it's something we deal with, I think, every day, and we just keep trundling along, and hopefully someday we'll have better tools at our disposal to go after these folks.
And you do this somewhat formally or contractually with publishers, right? Is that one of the things that Griffin Publishing Consulting does?
No, I don't do searches or, you know, DMCA notice and takedowns. I don't do any of that stuff. I'm more on the licensing side. So I help publishers when they are trying to get permission maybe to use a particular photo in their publication, or conversely, like we were talking about a little few minutes ago, selling rights to other partner publishers overseas or for audio or for, you know, other formats, film, TV, that kind of thing. So I'm pretty much in that lane. There are companies that's all they do is go after, you know, pirates and infringers, but that's not me.
Right. Okay. So, talking about permissions a bit, what's your thinking on this? You're an independent publisher, and you want to get permission to use something. You kind of think, based on what you've read, that it falls under the category of fair use, even though you're not entirely sure what fair use means. You do know, though, that once you ask permission, then you're kind of honor-bound to follow the terms of the agreement. If they want money, you're going to have to pay it, or you're going to have to decide that you don't need the image. Whereas if you just go ahead and use whatever it is and think that you're okay on fair use grounds, you're going to roll the dice, maybe take your chances. You probably have this conversation with clients quite a bit. And what do you usually recommend to them?
Well, fair use is really a framework and is primarily used for in cases of infringement. It's sort of a defense against an infringement charge, but it's something that I try and steer my clients away from, just because in a lot of cases with publishing, there are four factors, and one of the factors deals with the nature of the use, the purpose and character of the use, and if that use is commercial. So if you're making money on something, then your use may technically not be fair, depending upon how the other four factors line up. So in my mind and in my advice usually to clients is to certainly take a look at fair use, but it's usually better to ask for permission rather than just try and run away from it to begin with, because if you end up on the end of an infringement suit, you could end up owing some money for that infringement. And in some cases, and what I do as well, is try to make sure that any of those permissions contracts or permissions are, the fees are very low, that the terms are not that restrictive. That's my job. And so, you know, in some cases, it's really not as onerous as people make it out to be. But fair use definitely is a thing that publishers can use. I just don't think that it's something that you should get into the habit of using all the time, because you could get yourself into trouble.
Right. And it's only fair use after someone has maybe a judge has decided it is, when they take you to trial.
Right. The judge is the one that actually uses those four factors and lines that up against how it's used. So, you know, the four factors of fair use are the purpose and character of the use, whether it's, including whether it's commercial or not, the nature of the original work. So if the original work was meant to, you know, sustain an author in some way or another, then that might work against you. How much of the original use that you used, including if the piece that you're using is what might be termed the heart of a work. And in that case, you can kind of think of a poem or a song lyric or a groundbreaking new story, something like that. And then the effect of that use on the potential market against the market for the copyrighted work. So all of those are weighed together by the judge. And again, a publisher can do that analysis. I can help them to do that analysis, but they need to make that decision and in cooperation with their lawyer, who is not me. Right. I'm not a lawyer. So.
But you do provide a lot of useful services to publishers to maybe keep them out, that would eventually keep them out of legal trouble anyway. So if people want to get in touch with you, what is the best way?
Certainly take a look at my website, griffinpublishingconsulting.net, and it's Griffin spelled with a PH instead of any F's or I's. So it's that's one way. They can also shoot me an email. The email address is info@griffinpublishingconsulting.net. It's super long, but GRYPHON publishingconsulting.net. I'm happy to have a chat. All IBPA members are eligible for a free 30-minute discussion with me. We can start with 15 minutes and go on from there. But I welcome anybody to reach out, and I'm happy to see if I can lead them down the path they need to go.
That's great. Well, that's very generous of you. Well, thank you very much, Mary Jo. It's been wonderful talking to you. And next year, in Frankfurt, maybe.
Yes, Prost.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Mary Jo Corshane of Griffin Publishing Consulting. Now, at some point we were talking about fair use, and I really need to emphasize that this is a very tricky subject. So before you grab something from someone else's book or website, be sure you understand the criteria that are used to determine fair use, and then use the materials to make your best decision as to whether or not you're obligated to ask for permission. And one thing that comes to mind is the nature of your usage. If you have a nonfiction book and are using a quote from another book to buttress your argument or provide a citation, then that may fall under what's called an editorial use and is probably not a problem. But it really depends, again, on how much of a work you're citing. On the other hand, if you're assembling a book of quotes or using other people's work as decorative elements that are not used in an editorial sense, you really should consider getting permission for all these uses. Now, getting permissions can be a lot of work, especially if you're assembling one of those quotation books. You may have more than 100 places to track down, for example, and it can be expensive since some places may have minimum charges that cover just the cost of preparing and archiving a permissions letter to send you. So costs can run up, even to the point where the project becomes completely unaffordable. So you may have to rethink what you're doing. Just because something is online, or because other people don't seem to be getting permission, or because it's way too much work to research and contact the rights holders, that does not mean you can get away with using other people's work for free. Aside from the ethical obligation of paying artists and writers fairly for their work, you really do risk exposing yourself to complaints and lawsuits, which in the end may prove a lot more expensive. It would be really nice if the corporate holders of copyrights were more sympathetic, say, to the needs of independent writers and publishers, but that's like asking bookstores to voluntarily do away with returns or Jeff Bezos to cut you a break. Ain't gonna happen. So make sure you know the risks before you proceed. Well, please let me know your thoughts at Peter Goodman or at IBPA on Twitter. And be sure to check out IBPA at ibpa-online.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Peter Goodman, and as my bosses in Japan used to say, let's have publishing fun and stay safe.